Beautiful song, beautifully sung. Matthew chapter 5. I listened recently to an interview conducted by Ben Shapiro, an Orthodox Jew, with John MacArthur. Ben asked John to talk about the difference between Judaism and Christianity. He prefaced the whole thing by noting how much the two religions have in common and how often the two of them are on the same side of moral issues and such. Shapiro suggested that the only real difference appears to be what one does with the last part of the Bible, whether to file it under the fiction section or the nonfiction section. Now, dropping that particular question in front of John MacArthur is a good bit like dropping a T-bone steak in front of my dog, Lucy. And he did a stellar job of responding. I hope to be able to capture that interview and perhaps use it on Easter Sunday morning, as it just has a particular interest, that time between our breakfast and the morning service. Use it in there as an opportunity for us to rejoice in words well put, very gracious, very specific. It occurred to me that I was witnessing a one-on-one conversation remarkably like the discourse found in Matthew 5, 6, and 7 we call the Sermon on the Mount. Jesus is on the hillside looking out over the Sea of Galilee. His disciples have gathered in close around him, but there is a great crowd, a great multitude of mainly Jewish people who are scattered about on that hillside listening to the words of Jesus as he sits there teaching his message. Now, these people are curious to hear about this remarkable teacher. Maybe they've heard some of his words before. Maybe they have recognized that he's accomplished some incredible miracles, some healings, some very challenging things. And some of them are just wanting to know what he's doing. They've all grown up Jewish. They know the scriptures pretty well. That was something that Ben Shapiro mentioned in his interview, that he said, well, you know, growing up as an Orthodox Jew, I studied the scriptures regularly and read them three times a day and know them quite well. They would tell you that of all the people in the world, they understand what it means to know God. They are, after all, God's chosen people. The Romans certainly don't know God, and the Samaritans up north of them just a bit, well, they don't know God. But for 2,000 years, these people have been the Jewish people, God's chosen people, the people of the one true God. And the Lord has given them his law through Moses. And before that, through their father Abraham, God has promised them this marvelous kingdom that they've been hearing about. And this king who would come one day and deliver them from all of the difficulties that they have faced. Their prophets had expanded on the idea God was coming someday to rule the world, to set all things right. And while they waited, suffering under the cruel Romans, they strive to keep the law of Moses as best they can. And they have their experts who help them along to tell them what they need to do and what they need to not do. They can pray and take part in festivals and bring their sacrifices and pay their tithes and eat the right foods and observe the Sabbath day. Well, maybe just the best among them do all of those things even moderately well. And then Jesus shows up and he brings this 8-statement introduction to his sermon. We called them the Beatitudes. Beatus is the Latin word for blessing. And so we call them Beatitudes. He isn't sounding like your average rabbi as he goes through those eight Beatitudes that we've already taken a look at one by one. The good news of the kingdom, according to Jesus, is only good news to those who cannot make a passing grade on their own. The good news of the kingdom is only good news to those who recognize their own spiritual bankruptcy and who mourn over their sin and who repent and hunger after righteousness, thirst after righteousness, and who know God's mercy and the purity only God can grant. Only those people will know this God and will experience this King in this kingdom that is future. The Pharisees say, you must attain this kingdom. Jesus is saying, he's come that they might obtain, not attain it, but obtain real righteousness through him. It's a very different message. He finishes the Beatitudes with the assurance that this message, this good news of the kingdom, this true righteousness that cannot be earned, is going to bring all takers a world of hurt. They're going to experience persecution, difficulties along the way. The self-righteous Pharisees won't want to hear that all of their spiritual investments just tanked. The rank sinners don't want to hear that they cannot dig them out of the hole they've dug themselves into. And as these people who embrace the message that Jesus is speaking declare the righteousness of God to the world around them, they're going to become public enemy number one. And now in verses 13 to 16 of Matthew chapter 5, Jesus shifts the focus of the discussion from who these blessed people are to what they're to be doing. From identity to purpose. From who is a kingdom citizen to what is a kingdom citizen supposed to do while he remains a citizen on this sin-cursed earth. So let's take a look just at verse 13 to begin with. You are the salt of the earth. But if the salt has become tasteless, how can it be made salty again? It is no longer good for anything except to be thrown out and trampled underfoot by men. Now, when we're thinking just in terms of being salt, let's think, first of all, about the people Jesus is talking to out on that Galilean hillside. Back in verse 1, we're told when he sat down, his disciples came to him. That would be at least the 12, the disciples. Disciple means learner. It may have been more than just 12 people, people who somehow qualified as a disciple, as a learner. But there was also this multitude of people, the crowd of people who were chasing Jesus around the countryside, hoping to perhaps be entertained, perhaps to seek some miracle, some healing, to have their curiosity satisfied. Maybe some were intrigued and interested in his words. He was somehow different than the religious leaders of his day. He spoke with authority, and the rabbis, the people in leadership spiritually around them would always say, well, Rabbi so-and-so says this, and Rabbi so-and-so says this. Jesus said, well, let's talk about what God says. And it was refreshing, and it was frightening, and it was a ray of light in a dark time, and maybe he was the promised Messiah. The time was right. There was a prevailing sense among the people in Israel that it was the appointed time for the promised one to appear. There were something like 40 individuals during this time of history where people would rise up and claim to be that promised Messiah. The people who had done the math in the Old Testament knew that it ought to be now. It ought to be right now. And on Sunday nights, we've been looking at the Dead Sea Scrolls, and we took a look at a group called the Essenes, who were convinced that the kingdom was at hand just in this period of time. So Jesus is talking to disciples, but he's also talking to this multitude. And what does Jesus say? He says, "You are salt." He doesn't say, "You should be salt," as if a choice exists. I can sign up and be salt, or I can not be salt. He doesn't say, "You possess salt," as if salt were the message that they would have to proclaim to the world, and you can scatter the salt among this world in which we live. He says, as disciples of the King, the entire world is to be salted by us, by our lives, by who we are, that we are salt. The verses here that we're looking at today are called the similitudes. They are you're similar to. It's like the word simile, or more specifically here, a metaphor where he just says you are salt, you are light. And so the world must deal with a foreign substance. They may not like it, as the last beatitude indicates. There's going to be persecution. But the Christians, the very ones hated and even persecuted by the world, are very significant to the world, and the world has much to gain by our influence. So what are the qualities of salt? That's a question that we have to take a look at. First of all, value. In the ancient world, the Greeks thought it contained something almost divine. We take it pretty much for granted. We can go to the grocery store and buy a box of Morton's and take it home and have salt for a long time to come. And it doesn't cost too much. But back in that day, salt was an expensive thing. It was, in fact, rare enough that the Romans often paid their soldiers partially with salt. That would be part of their paycheck. The phrase, "a man worth his salt," derives from that particular practice. And in fact, the part of their pay that was salt was called the salarium, which gives us the word today, salary. Well, where did that word come from? Well, it comes from salt, and it comes from this particular practice. So salt was something of great value and something that was revered in the ancient world. Our message is that people carry the divine image. And we say God so loved the world that he gave his son. Our message is of great value. Peter Singer is a professor of bioethics at Princeton. God save us all from him. He wrote, "The notion that human life is sacred just because it is human life is medieval." More recently, he said that a baby that's born has no more right to be alive than a chimpanzee. And we come along and we say, oh no, every life is precious. Every life is stamped with the image of God, the Imago Dei. Every life is of infinite value. We have a message to the world that don't listen to the people who say you just rose up out of the primordial ooze and plopped up on the the shore of some ancient ocean and somehow changed into a lizard and then a panda bear and then people. It was all by chance. It was all just a mistake. It was random. It was just matter and motion and time. And that leads to a philosophy of despair. And we have a message that says, no, don't listen to those crazy people. Listen to us. And they say, those people are crazy. They look at us and think we're crazy. We're saying, no, you have great value. So salt has value as a quality. It also has purity as a quality due to its sparkling crystals and its whiteness. The Romans called salt the purest of all things. As salt, we can expect to have the demand of purity laid upon us. Our standards must be resolute. The world will demand a higher standard for you when you declare yourself to be a follower of Jesus than they have for themselves. They will say, oh, you call yourself a Christian and yet you do this thing. And you can't come back and say, well, everybody does that thing. I say, well, yeah, but you identify yourself as a Christian. Honesty, moral life above reproach, a work record that ought to reflect diligence. Got to be the hardest worker in your place of business. People ought to say, oh, that guy, yeah, he's a Christian, and that's a little kooky, but I got to say, he's a great employee. He does his job, he does it well. And I never have to go back and check. He's just a great individual. Purity. Preservation. A major use of salt in New Testament times was to prevent decay. They didn't have refrigerators and freezers, but they had salt. It restrains corruption. It acts as an antiseptic. Like the lead bars in a nuclear reactor, it holds back corruption, like a team of mules being driven, but the driver is pulling back on the reins. Salt would hold back the forces of nature. They didn't invent hard tack because they liked the taste of salt. They invented hard tack because that's the way you could preserve meat and have it last longer. Christians are to hold back their society from plunging headlong into disaster, to cry out, stop. Stop what you're doing. The story of Telemachus as gladiators were being slaughtered in the Colosseum for the amusement of people, and people would gather for the big game, and they would watch this happen. And I said big game because you couldn't call it something else. And what is today? I don't know. But anyway, Telemachus, finally, just out of his compassion, his heart, he ran out onto the field, and he said, stop. Stop what you're doing. And the story is told that the people filed out and those Colosseum death events ceased. Christians are to be the Telemachuses of the world. What's the danger? Let me back up. I've left out a bit. Salt may sting. The salty message of God's judgment and grace is a biting thing, but it will slow corruption. You ever been the only person in the room who didn't laugh at a really, really terrible joke? Not terrible dad joke, but a terrible joke that was off-color, racist. That's an awkward thing. Worked for the highway department, and boy, that happened just about every day. And there was Starbuck over there, not laughing. And okay, he's not laughing. You're like the bump in their log of progress. Ever respond to an affront with the spirit of forgiveness and love while others are fully expecting indignation and anger and hatred? There's a healing factor introduced to a situation when you do that. You ever have someone stand up and declare, no, what you are proposing is just wrong and I'll have no part in it? And everybody looks at each other and they say, you know what, that's right. What were we thinking? When one Christian radiates the peace of God amidst the anguish of hopelessness in the world, there's hope for others. Salt creates thirst. There's a professor of Greek and New Testament at London University. His name was R.V.J. Tasker. And so he's teaching Greek. He's teaching New Testament. Brilliant scholar. Not at all a follower of Jesus. But there was a student in his class who was a part of the InterVarsity Christian Fellowship. And one day, Dr. Tasker pulled that college student aside, this young man. Here is this eminent scholar. He pulls this college kid aside and he says, what is it that you have that I do not have? I want what you have. That's what I'm talking about. And I have commentaries on my bookshelf written by Dr. Tasker. Didn't know this story until just recently. Value, purity, preservation. Perhaps the greatest characteristic in view here in Matthew 5 is flavor. Flavor. Salt brings flavor out. Job 6:6, the very first reference in all of literature of the world that mentions salt, as far as we know, is Job 6, verse 6. Can that which is tasteless be eaten without salt? Must have been talking about cauliflower. A Christian living with beatitude characteristics is not going to be a sad, sorrowful creature who never smiles. There ought to be a freshness, an enlivening, a joy, a sense of wonder, a radiance about us. We don't always do such a great job at bringing flavor to our surroundings, but we're salt to this bland world in which we live. Do you see how people are removing the idea of wonder from everything that we have marveled over in the past? We're definitely losing our marvels. Christmas. Take away all of the wonder of Christmas and we turn it into whichever, you know, just take your pick, whichever holiday you want. We're going to put them all at the end of December there and you can just kind of spin the wheel and do whichever one you like. And we'll put up little images that don't mean anything and we'll take the focus off of God becoming man and dwelling among us. Wonder. Birth. The birth of a baby. A wondrous thing. And we hear what they're doing in New York and some of the other states up in New England and taking away the wonder. It's not a big deal. It's just something that happens or not. And we get to decide the or not. And we lose a sense of wonder. We are to be bringing the flavor. Saying, oh, there's a whole kingdom out there that's coming and it's going to be wonderful. It's going to be great. The king is coming and we ought to be ready. And it's not just for the sweet by and by. It's for the nasty now and now. We get to enjoy the benefits of being kingdom citizens right now. A Christian living with beatitude characteristics will not be this guy who's walking around sad all the time. Howard Voss, professor, put it this way: believers can bring a special kind of grace and pleasantness to an otherwise ugly and unhappy world. The world is out there painting everything Soviet gray. We don't want anything to stand out. We don't want to talk about anything religious. We don't want to bring God into the public square. We want to just get rid of all of that and just pretend that it all just happened by chance and who cares. So the danger of salt is stated here. He says, if the salt has lost its savor. Now, to be as scientific as I can be, and I'm not much of a scientist, sodium chloride, salt, does not lose its savor. So what's he talking about? The salt used in Jesus' day normally contained a good amount of impurities that could turn alkaline and stale over time. The Dead Sea salt, I read, is often got gypsum and other impurities mixed into it. And over time, the salt can lose its savor. Why does he say that? Why does he bring that idea up? What's this all about? Well, the Jewish nation was supposed to bring all of these salt qualities to the world, value and purity and preservation and flavor. That was their job. Ben Shapiro told John MacArthur that, sometimes these Christians, they seem like they're trying to establish a theocracy. And he says, and that kind of scares me. And MacArthur had this knowing little smile as he waited for Ben to finish his comment. And he said, well, that was your job. Israel was to be a theocracy. God was the king. And he's kind of like, oh, yeah, walked into that one. That's who these people out here in the far reaches of the multitude, that's where they're coming from. All too often they had isolated themselves from into their own little communities and away from others, refusing to share the treasure of God's word that had been placed in their stewardship. God had given it to them so they could be a lighthouse to the world, so they could be the keepers of God's word and distribute it to the whole world. And they're guilty of damming up the river of God's blessing to water their own little garden and not allowing it to go out beyond that. Those who didn't isolate themselves chose instead to assimilate into the cultures around them. Jesus may have looked at his disciples up close and said, you are the salt of the earth. And then he may have looked out beyond that. I think if I were making a movie of this, I would do it this way. Looked out at the multitudes around them and said, now if the salt has lost its savor, what use is it? Those outliers still clinging to the savorless religion by the scandalous priests in Jerusalem and by the self-righteous scribes and the Pharisees who ran the synagogues, they're just kind of going through these motions, and there's no flavor, there's no preservation, there's no purity, there's no value. They're just kind of doing their thing. They're like churches who have lost their message, and yet they still meet and they dress up in their little outfits and they go through their motions, and you got to wonder why. And so Jesus is calling them out. You have the law. you have Abraham and you have the promises given to Abraham. But if you're savorless salt, there's nothing to do but to scatter you on the pathway and just be trodden underfoot. Powerful. You're salt. And then he goes on to say, you're the light of the world. And verses 14 to 16 on being light. You are the light of the world. A city set on a hill cannot be hidden, nor does anyone light a lamp and put it under a basket, but on the lampstand, and it gives light to all who are in the house. Let your light shine before men in such a way that they may see your good works and glorify your Father who is in heaven. I'll talk about purpose. As light, we will be the visible community of God, citizens of the kingdom. We will be that visible community. Last year, I went to the graduation down at the Visible Music College. They call it the Visible Music College because we're supposed to be visible in the world. As Christians, we're supposed to be visible for all to see. And I like that. The illustration of the city set on a hill would immediately call to the Jewish listener's mind the city of Jerusalem. That's a city set on a hill. You know, in their world, when you talked about going to Jerusalem, you always talked about going up to Jerusalem. Even if you were going south, you were going up to Jerusalem. Cities were often found on hilltops for protection against enemies, for breezes, because it was a hot, arid land, and to be up on that hillside would put you in a good position to capture the breezes that were there. But a city set on a hill, one thing you can't do when you put the city up on a hill is to hide it, because people can see it for miles around, and the glow from that city is evident from a long distance away. There is an openness and a visibility that is inescapable, and the church cannot operate within the privacy of our four walls. The church is to be visible. We're not to isolate ourselves from the culture. We're not to assimilate into the culture. We're to engage the culture. We're to be visible. But you say, well, wait a minute, because I just read that last beatitude, and it says that there's persecution. So if it's okay, I'll just kind of not be a city on a hill. And Jesus has an answer for that. Nothing would please the world more than for us to confine ourselves. Yeah, you hear some people who are critical of your beliefs say, you know what, that's for you to talk about in your church, but don't drag that stuff into our schools, into our government schools, and don't drag that stuff into the marketplace, and don't expect us to talk about that stuff on the evening news. You see all the coverage of the Walk for Life in Washington, D.C. last month? Me neither. But then I didn't look because I'm used to not seeing it, and I just decided not to bother looking. One time we had a huge group of people who were outside the abortion clinics here in Memphis, and I watched the news, the local news, and there was nothing. I changed the channel, and there was nothing. And so I called one of the news stations, and I said, hey, there were a whole bunch of people out on Poplar Avenue this afternoon. What was that? I watched your news, and I didn't see anything. I just wondered what was going on. And he said, oh, it was a protest. I said, oh, what were they protesting? He said, well, it was about abortion. And I said, oh, were they for it or against it? He goes, both. No. But that's the kind of thing we can expect. But we ought to be visible, and we ought to be engaging, not isolating, not assimilating, declaring that we are kingdom citizens. As light in a dark world, we're to have impact dispelling the darkness and spilling out into the marketplace and the schools and the political realm and the personal lives of people we come to know, and bringing that light. We ought not to be able to hide it. As light, we will be a radiant community. And the characteristic of light that most clearly, I think, parallels that of salt is this radiating effect that it has. Out of the blessed lives of beatitude-transformed lives, kingdom citizens will radiate the light of Christ, and it is a reflected light. It's His light. It's not something we can come up with on our own. It will have the effect of driving out the darkness. Adrian Rogers was fond of saying, as he recognized the sinfulness of our society, it's getting gloriously dark. And by that he meant, the darker it gets, the brighter our light will be in the contrast of the situation, the more effective we can be in bringing the light. We can sit around and wring our hands over all the terrible things that are happening and how we're losing our society, or we can realize that our job is not to rescue society. Our job is to bring light into darkness. You ever experience total darkness? Been a couple times where I've been in places that were just absolutely dark, where the hand in front of the face just couldn't see it. And that's a difficult place to be. When I was in Ecuador as a college student, and I was on the Pacific Ocean beach with a bunch of children at a camp, we had some of those old wooden cases with 24 bottles of soda pop. And so I got about four of those, and I thought, I'll just take this back to the bus. So I went over the sand dune, and I went down, and all of a sudden, there was nothing. There were no lights. There were no stars. It was overcast. And I knew the bus was right there, but it wasn't. I thought, oh, this is good. I'm in big trouble. There's no light at all. And I remember putting those cases down and walking up the next sand dune, and there was the light of the bus over there. And I thought, oh, a light in a dark place. That's the kind of joy that we ought to be bringing to people. You know, I can shed some light on your dark world here. I can bring you hope where there's hopelessness, and I can bring you foundness where there was lostness. And we ought to love that. We ought to be a radiant community. It will affect the way we treat the shopkeeper, the way we drive, the way we speak to someone in need. It will come as a beacon of hope to some, like the student in Dr. Tasker's class who was just living as light. And I don't know the whole story. I would love to know the story of the conversations that he must have had, the questions the student must have asked, the comments that he might have made along the way to make Dr. Tasker say, I don't know what it is you have, but I want it. The possibility of hiding our light does exist, like the salt that loses its savor. If we decide our little saucer of olive oil with its little wick might not withstand the wind, we might decide, well, let's just put it under a basket for the time being so that it doesn't blow out, because then I won't have any light for myself. Never mind everybody else. What good would it be to them if the light went out altogether? Or if we just decide we want to take a little nap, we want to kind of absence ourselves from the light for a time and step off into the darkness for a bit and participate in some of those deeds of darkness, maybe we want to hide the light. But a light under a basket will soon starve itself of oxygen and it will go out. And besides, that's not what lights are for. To hide it under a basket makes no sense. If you ever decide to play it cool or to keep quiet or to avoid controversy, it won't work. You know what? God will set your basket on fire. And then you'll have this big blaze going up and everybody will say, hey, look at that guy. And he was hiding that. Where did that come from? He'll expose your hypocrisy. We're a radiant community, and we ought to live that way, being light, warm and life-giving and way-showing light. The purpose of letting our light shine is there in verse 16, that men may see your good works. Now in Greek, there are two ways to say good. Agathos gives us the name Agatha, means good. And that's good in quality. Something that's a very high quality thing is good. But here Jesus uses a different word, the word kalos. Not simply good, but winsome and attractive and beautiful. Isn't that great? Men may see your winsome works. Men may see your attractive works. Men may see your beautiful works and glorify your Father who is in heaven. People will see your right attitudes. They'll see your family. They'll see your church. They'll see your quiet trust in those dark times of life and they'll say, that's winsome. Men may be motivated to glorify God for wrong reasons. The Pharisees, for instance, were motivated to pretend to be glorifying God so that people could see how well they glorified God. But I want to glorify God because He saved me from my sin. Because He transformed me by His grace. Because Jesus died for me, that I might have life and have it abundantly, that I might be salt and light in the world in which we live right now. Let's go to prayer. Father, what a challenge to be salt and light in a world that is morally decayed and spiritually dark. Lord, we pray as we come to this table that you would set our hearts on the purpose for which you've left us here, Lord. You didn't save us and take us instantly to heaven. You left us here with our dual citizenship. We pray that we might live as salt and light in a world that so much needs it. So, Father, may this be a time of worship and communion and joy with you. I invite you to continue in prayer as we prepare the table now.